This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's Labor Day when most Americans enjoy a day off in honor of the work they put in year-round. But even if you throw in 9 more federal holidays and 2 weeks of vacation, Americans don't get anywhere near as much time off as most Europeans do. France and Germany pretty much shut down during the month of August. In France, there's a mandated 35-hour work week, and workers spend 30% less time at the office than we do. Americans work longer hours than anyone in the industrialized world, and we tend to retire later, too. The gap between European and American work habits may be narrowing for a variety of reasons we'll talk about in just a moment, but for the time being, at least, the difference between America and Europe remains stark. In general, Americans say they like work better, along with the higher salaries that come with it. Europeans prefer leisure, more time off. This hour, a look at the trade-offs, personal and economic. Later in the program, we'll go to Baghdad to hear about another bloody day in Iraq and new demands for the release of 2 French reporters. But first, living to work versus working to live. Which side of the coin do you fall on? What's more important to you, higher income or more leisure? And if you've been abroad lately, call and tell us whether you noticed a difference in work habits. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Raymond Torres, an economist at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. He's on the phone from his home in Paris. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello.
And I understand there are some calls for a longer work week in Europe.
Indeed. What happens is that certain enterprises in Europe are being hit by international competitiveness issues. And as a result of this, there is pressure to increase working hours in those enterprises while keeping wages constant.
You talk about international competitiveness. In this country, we hear about outsourcing, as it's called, to India sometimes or other countries. Where are jobs going from Europe?
Well, that's exactly the same phenomenon, that in some European countries there is pressure in particular sectors for jobs to go also to India in particular sectors, or more often in the case of Eastern Europe, which are new members of the European Union. And what happens is that in those enterprises being hit by international competitiveness, employers say, well, if I don't increase working hours for the same wage or keep the same hours but with lower wages, in this case, I might go to another country, why not Slovakia or Czech Republic or whatever. That's the factor.
Let me just double-check something there. They're saying either more hours for the same pay or the same hours for less pay.
Exactly. And so that's the way they propose to improve competitiveness. And of course, what happens, perhaps that's somewhat new, is that workers in this situation prefer the same wage, no cut in pay, but with longer hours. That's the way they prefer in order to improve competitiveness. Now, the real issue is to what extent enterprises are telling exactly the truth. They've really been hit by low competitiveness, because some people say that enterprises are using this as an excuse in order to improve profits and profitability of their activities. And in fact, it's not clear that they would delocalize their activities or outsource them to other countries. So that's a real issue for workers, to decide whether they think that what the employers are telling them is absolutely true. They do have, particularly individual employers, a competitiveness issue, or whether, on the contrary, employers are simply saying, well, maybe we go elsewhere, but in fact, they would be happy to stay. And if workers accept this increase in working hours with the same pay, they would, of course, enjoy higher profits.
Now, the French 35-hour work week, and indeed shorter hours throughout Europe, one of the reasons they were brought in was the idea, well, you know, we can spread the work around. This will help lower the unemployment rate. Has that worked?
It's very difficult to tell, because at the same time the measure was taken, other measures were adopted, and it will be difficult, if not impossible, to ever evaluate the impact of employment. But anyway, existing studies suggest that something like 300,000 jobs were created as a result of the 35-hour work week. But at the same time this happened, enterprises improved flexibility in the use of working hours, and that led to increased productivity in certain sectors. So in other words, the shorter work week was accompanied with improved productivity as a result of work organization, and this helped reduce the impact on competitiveness in those sectors. Nevertheless, it seems that central enterprises are being hit by international competitiveness, and therefore the positive side of the 35-hour work week, the increase in productivity has not been completely offset the negative side of increasing costs.
Would you estimate that you're going to be seeing a longer hours per week per worker in Europe and maybe even shorter vacations?
I don't think you can generalize the trend. We are talking about particular enterprises in certain sectors, for example, in particular electricity sectors, which are being delocalized, or the threat is that they would delocalize or outsource activities. But I don't think we are talking about a generalized trend overboard across the economy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Raymond Torres, an economist at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, and he joined us by phone from his home in Paris. Work habits are a reflection of many economic factors, and here to explain how economic forces in Europe and America shape their citizens' work habits is Richard Freeman, a professor of economics at Harvard University. He's with us from the BBC studios in London, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi.
As we were just talking about with Raymond Torres, Western Europeans on average work far fewer hours than we do here in the States. Has it always been that way?
No. If you go back to the 1970s, the Americans worked fewer hours. We introduced the five-day week before the Europeans, and our two-week vacation that you referred to earlier, that was before the Europeans had 2 weeks in vacation. So this has happened over the last 30 years. That they have decided to take their wealth in leisure, and we have decided to take our wealth in more work.
Now, from what I understand, this disparity, despite those pressures that we were just talking about with Raymond Torres, is grown and growing.
Yes, it's grown quite a bit, and a group that it's very important to understand that women are critical in the additional work time that the Americans do. American women should be really the heroines, I suppose, of Labor Day, because they put in extraordinary amount of hours. They do both the housework and the jobs. And American women have children, and the European women don't have that many children.
We're talking about the trade-offs between the, those Americans who beaver away at their jobs and those Europeans who earn their extra money, maybe, in more leisure rather than money that they can put in the bank. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Carolyn, who's on the line with us from Anchorage in Alaska.
Yes, good morning, or good afternoon, your time.
Yes, thank you.
I wanted to bring up the question of the social costs of all this work versus more time in the home, although the gentleman just mentioned that European women have fewer children.
And
so
is
it's
that
not an issue of staying home and giving guidance either for males or females, which I'm in favor of, staying home and giving guidance to the children.
So you're talking about the social costs of having women heavily dedicated to the workforce.
Well, not just women, but just having the family time taken up with material pursuit as opposed to pursuit of social and cultural and other things that comprise a family.
And Richard Freeman, this is clearly something that goes into the equation as people evaluate these things.
Absolutely. I mean, what America has done is created large incentives for people to work very hard and for very long periods of time. And some of it is connected to the huge income inequalities we have in our country. So if you don't make it, you come out very poorly. And if you get promoted and get to be towards the top of your company, you get a lot of money. In Europe, the differences are much smaller, and so there's much less pressure on people, and they can take their time in other activities.
Carolyn, thanks very much.
You're quite welcome.
How did this shift happen? I mean, what was the particular, was there an engine to this, a lever that moved this issue for the Europeans versus the Americans?
Well, I think there were a couple of things that went on. One was that the Europeans, through legislation in some cases, you referred to the French passing the 35-hour work week, they enacted laws that said people should have 4 weeks vacation. Although in the United Kingdom, where there is no such law, people still take the 4 week vacation, and there would be a riot if you ever suggested that people would not take this this leisure activity. So I think as the U.S. income inequality got bigger and bigger, And as our social welfare state sort of shrunk, so the unemployment benefits in the United States relative to Europe are much less. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be unemployed. You better work pretty hard in order that when the time comes that there's going to be a layoff, you won't be the person who gets laid off. And in Europe, you could sit there and say, I'm working normal. Okay, there's a layoff. Fine, but my rent is going to be covered. I'm going to get reasonable unemployment benefits, and I don't have to break my back for in order to maintain my job.
And in a lot of places, I'm thinking about Germany here, it's very difficult to get laid off.
Yes, that there is greater protection. Now, that means, of course, that one group of people, namely, usually it's the adult men, are protected. But the younger people and the women are often not protected in this. They have greater trouble getting a job. So there's a balancing act there between the group that gets protected and the groups that are trying to find jobs.
Though, don't Europeans tend to retire younger than most Americans do?
Yes, they do. And that's a time bomb in Europe. The same way it is in the U.S., the social security systems all have problems. The private pension systems in the United Kingdom has a problem. So we all have to adjust to a world in which we're living longer and we really can't be retiring that early.
Let's get another caller on the line. Joe joins us from New Orleans.
Hi. One of the things that a lot of people in the mainstream really don't take into account is people with jobs like mine, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. I work in the maritime industry, I'm a merchant marine, and this whole five-day work week, I've never known a five-day work week in the 13 years I've been in this industry. And I think one of the biggest problems as a merchant mariner that I fall into is the mainstream world, and I'm sure it's like this with other foreign mariners as well, is nobody stops to think that we have no family, we have no home life. The divorce rate in this industry is extremely high, and what's the trade-off? We make a lot of money, but we don't ever really get to enjoy it, and we usually die young. And that's something I wanted to toss out there for you all to think about. Is there's a whole sector, this American workforce and even world workforce, that there's a lot that we have to put up with in order to keep the economy and the world economy going. We're the driving force behind most of the American economy. And we feed the world with our barges coming down the river and our ships going across the sea. And no one gives us any kind of consideration for that whatsoever.
Well, Joe, I think that extra money you talked about is the consideration. But if the job is like that, insurance is a good business. So why don't you change jobs?
It's not quite that easy because, this is an industry that you get wrapped up in. How do you change jobs when you only have a very short amount of time at home in order to do something? Yes, I'm educated. I did go to college, but I went to college for maritime business. And there's only so many jobs in this industry. And if you leave this industry, there's to where you could even cross over to go to. A lot of people in this industry don't even have a high school education. So where can they go and still be able to make 60, 70 grand a year?
Well, Joe, thanks very much. We appreciate, everything you do for the economy, but we also thank you for the phone call. Also, a lot of people, we have to remember, farmers don't exactly have structured hours and regular weeks and regular days off as well. So there's other parts of our economy that we have to remember aren't covered by a lot of the rules that we're talking about. Nevertheless, we are talking about the great bulk of workers in this country and the great bulk of workers in Europe. Big differences in the decisions that people make and the decisions that societies make as to how to structure those work weeks. Give us a call if you come down on one side or the other of Live to Work or Work for Live. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Neil Conan, and this is Talk of the Nation. We're talking about the differences between American and European work habits on this Labor Day, why Americans tend to work to live and Europeans live to work. Our guest is Richard Freeman, an economist at Harvard University. He's with us from the BBC studios in London, England. Also with us is Greg Easterbrook, a senior editor at The New Republic, author of the book The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse, and he's with me here in Studio 3A in Washington. Nice of you to join us today. And, of course, we want to hear from all of you as well. Our number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Greg Easterbrook, the economic incentives that Professor Freeman laid out seem to offer a choice of money versus leisure. Do we really have a choice, or are you in one system or the other?
Well, I think it's clear an awful lot of Americans choose work and materialism over the possible alternatives. And you'll hear, when you interview people, you'll hear them say, well, you know, I hate it that I work 60 hours a week. I hate it that I'm so money-focused. But if I wasn't so money-focused, how would I pay for this? How would I pay the mortgage on my 4,000-square-foot house? How would I pay the bills on my two SUVs and my motor, and my powerboat? How would I possibly pay for these new clothes, et cetera? So if you make the choice in life that you need the maximum practical amount of material things, then yes, you'll have to do the maximum possible amount of work. The question is, should you make that choice?
Richard Freeman, let me put that on the other foot. Does this mean that in Europe people are worried about, gee, our workers aren't buying enough new television sets and a new car?
No, they have television sets and they have cars. But what they do is spend more time with their family and on their holidays. The Europeans are pretty wealthy in the world perspective, the same way the Americans are. And so this isn't a question of people doing without.
Well, clearly they're doing with less. Their incomes are less.
Well, their incomes are less, but mostly the incomes are less at the top of the income distribution. That then you go down to the bottom of the income distribution, the lower parts, people's health care is covered. Their wages are closer to those of people in the middle. And so for a lot of people, it's not this dire choice. Now, of course, the example given of the person with the two SUVs, et cetera, that's one kind of person who has a choice in the U.S. But there's also the person who is working, let's say, as a janitor and has two janitor's jobs because they just don't make enough to pay rent. And the rents in the city of Boston, for instance, are very high. In New York City was very high. I don't know what Washington is like, but I assume it's also high. And so there are two sides of this. There are the people at the top for whom it really is, I think, much more of a choice. And then there are the people at the bottom who are oppressed.
Well, Greg Easterbrook, there's the other part of the equation that we're not talking about. We can measure income. We can translate one currency to another. Happiness is harder to measure.
Yes, and if you it is a squishier number than per capita income is, but if you measure happiness, you don't find a whole lot that's encouraging. If you take, let's say, compare the current United States to the year 1950 when the post-war recovery began, our per capita real dollar income is almost treble what it was then. Living standards are way up. The typical home size, for instance, has doubled in that period. Life expectancy is up. Education levels are up. People report that they're no happier than they were in the year 1950. And if you take the measure of the incidence of clinical depression, there's statistical disputes having to do with how much it's risen given to better diagnosis and so on. But clinical depression has risen 3 to 10 times today what it was adjusted for population in 1950. So with all the wonderful material things around us, and Americans and Western European society have been fabulously successful at producing material things, we're no happier than we used to be. These statistics are about the same for Europe, and there's a great deal more people now who are depressed than there once were.
Or at least who are seeing people about it. Yes. Another thing that's hard to measure. Let's get some more callers on the line. Jack joins us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say that in the United States, companies, many big companies, have realized that it's a lot cheaper for them if they lay off some employees and then take the employees that are left and force them to work overtime against their will. And the employees only have one choice. You have to work the overtime or you get fired. I worked for a Baby Bell for 28 years, and when they laid off a bunch of employees, they made all of us work overtime, plus they made us carry a pager and do pager duty and call outs in the middle of the night. I would prefer to have more leisure time and less money, but I was unable to do so. And I think that's inappropriate. I think that people should be able to work a 40-hour work week if they want, and then if they want to quit after 40 hours, they should be able to go home. But we can't do that here in the United States. I think that's unfortunate.
Well, Greg Easterbrook, a lot of people say they don't have a choice. A lot of people like Jack.
Oh, yeah, and I think Jack's got a very good point. Anybody who's in an industry, this happens in the auto industry a lot, where people find themselves working forced overtime at the same time that there's layoffs or slow hiring. You get essentially a maximization of misery, because there are some people who want jobs and can't find them, and others who get great overtime wages but have more work than they actually want and less time with their family and to relax than they actually want. And probably this is a fault in U.S. labor law.
Jack, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Here's an email we got. The caller, this is referring to a caller earlier in the program, talked about staying home and guiding children. Another social cost is the lack of involvement in community. People volunteer less at their place of faith in local schools. They are less connected within neighborhood cities, etc. It really isolates people. I fear Americans care less and less about each other and our nation slash community as a whole because of it. Richard Freeman, as you look across European societies there, is there any indication that because they have more leisure time, Europeans are freer to join those kinds of civic associations?
No, they don't. The Americans do much more volunteering than the Europeans. But that's in Europe, they'll say, well, that's the job of the state, and the state has these things. So charitable activities, going to your church and doing good deeds is, it turns out, much more an American phenomenon, driven much more by the fact that we don't have a government that does a lot of these activities.
Let's take another caller. Liz joins us from Heidelberg in Germany.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Well, thanks for calling.
Yeah, we've been over here in Germany I've been here for about 8 years, but my husband's been working here for 11. He's American also. And I just wanted to make the point that at his level, he's a managerial level position, almost all of the guys sort of in his level, and we hear this kind of around, not just in his company, are all working way more than 40 hours a week, which would be more like it was, and it is in the States. But to counterbalance that, I suppose he does have 6 weeks of vacation, which he takes, and we enjoy.
As you now have had the opportunity, Liz, to look at this, I guess, from both sides of this work ethic divide, is either preferable? Do both have their points of view?
Yeah, I think there are definitely pros and cons, because you do see within the system here that people who, there is a level of job security here that tends to, I think, create a situation for some people where they're not actually performing in their jobs, and they're just sort of punching in and punching out and thinking that they're never going to be fired, because it's not a very common practice here. So I don't think that the work ethic, sometimes when you hear some stories, is maybe as high here. However, having the kind of free time and the emphasis on spending time with your family, in addition to the fact that stores aren't even open here on Sundays, sort of forces you to be with your family. I hated that at first when I moved here, but now I think it's a really wonderful thing, actually.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call, Liz. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And good luck to you.
Thanks.
Let me ask our guests, as you look at these different economic models we've been talking about, and various callers have been illustrating it, let me ask Greg Easterbrook, the European economic model, is it going to be sustainable? We just heard news, I guess, last week of efforts in Germany to cut back on some social spending, causing a great concern there in Germany. Liz was talking about the difficulty of even disciplining some workers.
Well, many aspects of economics have the quality of an arms race, and you're often forced to do things that you don't want to do because your opponent is doing them. The workers of Europe probably would vote if you could take a plebiscite to maintain long vacations and shorter work weeks. That's their choice, and you would think that if it was their choice to take out some of their national prosperity as leisure time, they should be able to make that choice to take out their prosperity that way instead of as SUVs and so on. But the global economy is getting ever faster and ever more competitive. For European companies to continue to compete, not just with Western companies, but developing world companies as well, their workers may not have a heck of a lot of choice other than to at least roughly match them on the amount of time they put in, the amount of work that they do.
Richard Freeman, let me ask you the same question.
Well, I can't imagine any European or American workers working as many hours as the Chinese do, or people in the developing countries. No, I think we can maintain leisure time if we want to, and there's an extra economic fact that can helps us. If it is the case, let's say Europeans want to maintain their leisure, and it turns out they can't compete with Americans very well, then the euro would go down relative to the dollar. And if the euro goes down, then the European products become equally competitive. Indeed, some of the discussion inside Europe is about the new lower-income countries who've joined the euro that will presumably have the currency, and therefore you can't do this. But there's no reason, as long as you have your currency can change, that you should be forced by any country or any outside force to change your lifestyle.
It used to be, as we talk about the different work ethics, Norwegians used to be renowned in Europe for unbending work ethic. A recent report by the OECD shows Norwegians call in sick to work more than anyone else in Europe. Moreover, they spend almost half their calendar year away from their jobs. Here to explain the situation is Finn Bergesen, Director General of the Confederation of Norwegian Business and Industry. He joins us by phone from his home in Oslo, Norway. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's good to be nice being with you.
From what I understand, on any given weekday, an estimated 25% of Norwegians opt to stay home from work. What's causing that?
Well, I think it is, there are many reasons for that. I think this may be a change in attitude. We have a very good welfare systems in Norway. Those welfare systems are also very demanding, of course. If you see that the citizens or workers are abusing it, it could boomerang and the system will not be sustainable. So what we have done, we have entered into a tripartite agreement between the employers, unions, and government, and we have a common goal to reduce the sick leave by 20%, and that means that we are going to involve both management and workers more heavily and sort of move the responsibility away from the public offices and into the enterprises.
In this country, the United States, if somebody called in sick that often, they might be in fear of losing their jobs. Is that the same kind of fear in Norway?
Well, it depends what it is. As long as you are sick, it's illegal, of course, and you cannot be fired if you are sick. And then you come to the definition of sickness. What is sickness? That's not some objective thing that you can decide that the person is not sick. So that's a wrong way, and that's a difficult avenue to walk down. What we have to do with in a common effort between the three parties to reduce it. And what we see now is that in the enterprises where they have taken this seriously, where management and have engaged themselves heavily, and also the union local representatives have engaged themselves, we have been able to reduce the sick leave by more than 20%, 30%, 40%.
And are you seeing economic effects from all of this time spent off work?
Of course. Of course. It's very costly both for the enterprises and for government. This is partly paid by the enterprise and partly by government. And we also see that it harms productivity.
Hmm. Well, Finn Bergesen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Finn Bergesen, Director General of the Confederation of Norwegian Business and Industry, with us by phone from his home in Oslo, Norway. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. As it happens, Monica is with us from Stavanger in Norway.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Monica.
Hi, I just want to comment on what Bergesen had to say from Oslo. I think the Norwegians have it correct in their work attitudes. I had lived in the United States, and now I've lived in Norway for 9 years. And here the mentality is that you go to work, you do your work, and you go home. And there's nothing about staying overtime or having FaceTime or you they put a much higher price on leisure time. And when the sun is out so long at 4 o'clock, you leave the office and you still have 8 hours of sunshine left. They really place a high value on their leisure time and family time. And the laws are built around having time for the woman to stay home. You could a year maternity leave paid for. And when people are on the job, though, their productivity rate is much higher. And I think that they know that when they go to work, they work very hard, but yet they do place an emphasis on being at home and spending time with the family.
Well, Greg,
so the society has a very high standard of living because of that.
And a high standard of living in part because of Norway's oil wealth, which is subsidizing a lot of the social benefits. But Greg Easterbrook, in terms of productivity, Monica's right. European workers are very productive.
Yes. And you know, I think Americans need to bear more in mind, especially people in white-collar and managerial occupations, that you don't really always need to be at the office till 8 or 9 o'clock at night. There's a tremendous amount of workplace machismo in current American society that boils down to people comparing notes and saying, well, I had to be at the office till 9 o'clock last night. Oh, yeah, well, I had to be at the office till 10 o'clock last night. We think that staying longer at work somehow makes us more important. You want your coworkers to see that when they're creeping out at night, to leaving at 8 o'clock to go home and actually have dinner, that you're still toiling away at your desk because your work is more important than theirs. I think an awful lot of, certainly if hourly workers who are being forced to do overtime, if they're doing 10 hours of work, they're actually doing 10 hours of work. But there's a huge number of Americans who are sitting in their offices just because they want to be in their offices for machismo reasons. They could actually be finished by 5 o'clock and out of there, and the nation would not suffer in the slightest.
Though sales of the game Battleship might suffer.
That's right.
Monica, it's getting on to, well, how late is it getting dark there now in Stavanger?
Getting on 5 o'clock, it's starting to get dark, and working our way to December, it'll get down to 4 o'clock. So we're in the southern part, so it's not dark all day long, but we don't have much light in the middle of the winter, that's for sure.
Well, we appreciate you keeping your radio on. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Monica, who's listening to us in Stavanger in Norway, we're going to continue this conversation when we come back from a short break. If you'd like to join us, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We'll also be going to Baghdad to hear about another bloody day. 7 U.S. Marines killed in a roadside bombing near Fallujah today. Also, new ransom demands being made for the release of 2 French reporters. We'll hear about that and your letters. So stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about working to live versus living to work, where Europeans and Americans fall into that continuum. Our guests are Richard Freeman, an economist at Harvard. He's with us from the BBC studios in London, England. And Greg Easterbrook, a senior editor at The New Republic, author of the book The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse. And he's with us here in Studio 3A in Washington. If you'd care to join us, 800-989-8255. You can also send us email totn@npr.org. And let's go to Dave. Dave is with us from Silicon Valley in California.
Hi, Neil. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think one point that nobody's touched on yet is that there's a really considerable disparity in economic growth and unemployment rates between Europe and the United States. And while it's harder to get fired in Europe, for example, it's also a lot harder to get hired. Harder to get kicked out of the system, but also harder to get brought into the system. And, you know, you've seen recession in Germany for, at least a decade, I believe, with double-digit unemployment rates. And when people talk about these great high standards of living and stuff that they're leading, it seems to me that the whole question of GDP growth slash development slash unemployment rates, all of which to me are kind of different aspects of the same issue, are kind of being ignored.
Richard Freeman?
Yeah, well, Germany, of course, has been a real disaster since they absorbed East Germany and made some terrible economic decisions. But the fastest-growing economy in the West is Ireland. The Dutch have been fast-growing. And in general, Europe has maintained the same level of per capita income relative to the U.S. that it had, let's say, 10 or 15 years ago. The big shock has been that Europe hasn't closed the gap with us. So I agree that the GDP per capita is important, but I don't think that that really says that people in Europe should, you know, be working 60 hours a week if they only want to work 40.
And Dave is right, though, on the unemployment figures.
Yeah. The unemployment in Europe has been higher than in the United States for a good, almost a decade now. That's correct. In the previous decade, Europe had lower unemployment than the United States. You kind of can pick these figures. Let me give you another one that would say the U.S. is not doing so well. We have a huge trade deficit. Europe has a trade surplus. That means that our dollar's getting less and less valuable in order for us to sell our goods overseas. So there are a number of sort of macro economic things that matter, and you can pick and choose among them.
Okay. Thank you, Dave, for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
One final thing, and it's an email question from Sam Black in Phoenix. As I listen to the program today, I'm catching up on several work projects on my day off. A laptop and a broadband connection allow me to work from almost anywhere and almost any time. Have your guests examined how new technology and the phenomenon of telecommuting has affected Americans' work patterns? Greg Easterbrook?
Well, you would think that all the trends in telecommuting and technology are going to be good for work and productivity. It may not be good for your soul or spirit to be checking your office email on a holiday. It's certainly got to be good for national productivity. But some trends in work, especially the trend of people working alone, may be one of the countervailing forces that explains why happiness is not rising at the same time that living standards and incomes are rising. Research tends to show, psychological research, that people are happier in groups than they are alone. You can find examples of people who are happiest living by themselves, but people, generally speaking, if you look at averages, people who come from large families are people happier than people who live in small families. People who work in large office environments are happier than people who work alone. People who attend lots of events, whether it's clubs or basketball games or anything, are happier than people who stay home and watch television. Human beings seem to be designed to interact with other people. It's one of the things that brings us the sense of well-being in life. And as technology, which I'm all in favor of, I mean, I can't even remember how I lived without email, and it's only been 6 or 7 years. As technology tends to drive us apart and have us work alone, this may be one reason why we don't feel any happier.
Well, Greg Easterbrook, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Sharing your Labor Day with us. Greg Easterbrook, a senior editor at the New Republic, and also thanks to Richard Freeman. I appreciate your going into the bureau there in London today for us.
Okay, thank you.
Richard Freeman, a professor of economics at Harvard University, and was with us from the studios of the BBC in London.